Hey, gang, are you in a band in Austin? You're looking to make the leap from the band of schmoes to the band of pros? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space. Space is a state-of-the-art affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. 31 spacious rooms, great PAs, and a very helpful and courteous staff. They have adapted to the COVID standards, and it is a very safe place to rehearse. You move in one way, you go in one door, you go out the other, you bring your own microphones. That's Space Rehearsal and Recording. Find them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com and take the talent train from Schmoesville to Protown with Space Rehearsal and Recording. Let's get down. Hey gang, we all know Spotify has become the ultimate app destination for music lovers. I have an account and I love it. I find new music by following Tastemaker playlists, and I make my own playlist that I share featuring music from guests that have been on the show. But did you know that aside from millions of songs, Spotify now has all of your favorite podcasts, including How Did I Get Here? Yes, all of your podcasts are available on Spotify. Just go to Spotify.com or download the app from your app store. And don't forget to follow How Did I Get Here? That's Spotify. Millions of songs, thousands of podcasts. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Howdy.
When we talked.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you do during the week. I've had a good week, I'm feeling better. And after those crazy storms and tornadoes and shit on Monday, it's really been a beautiful week. And so I've really taken advantage of it with Rosie. We've been going out places and going for like hikes and walks and enjoying the outdoors this week before I have to get back to work with Skyrocket next week. I've also done a bunch of podcasts, great podcasts this week. You'll hear them next week, man. A lot of great people, some people you might not have heard of, some people you have heard of, and even catching up with some people that have been on the show before. So it's been a great week. Better than last week where I was feeling like shit and South by Southwest was here. Before I got sick at South by Southwest, I only did one podcast last week, and it was with an old friend of mine, Hobart Rowland, who writes for Magnet Magazine. Now, Magnet Magazine, you might remember, was like a pretty heavy hitter out there on the magazine stands in the late 80s up until the early 2000s, focusing mostly on alternative music. And I spent that time mostly reading British magazines like Q and Mojo and stuff like that. But Magnet was one that focused on bands that I did like and I did listen to. And I did check out Magnet quite a bit during that time. And my friend Hobart's been writing for them for quite a few years. And he called me last year and told me that he was thinking about starting this podcast that was going to be focusing on classics from the Magnet's, from Magnet's heyday. Because Magnet no longer is a paper magazine. Now it's just online. You can find them at I think, magnetmagazine.com. But anyway, Hobart told me he wanted to start this podcast where they focused and did like a deep dive in an oral history where they got the artists and the producers and everyone involved to talk about the making of a certain record that has been a favorite of people throughout the last like 30 years or so. They did three episodes. He's put out three episodes so far. Pete Yorn, Music for the Morning After, Matthew Sweet Girlfriend, which is one of my top five albums of all time, Travis, The Invisible Band, all great records. And these shows are fantastic. He spends a lot of time putting these things together. And he also gets like special performances from each of the artists. MagnetClassicsPodcast.com. That's where you can find them. Hobart Rowland, great writer, great dude. And, you know, he told me he was coming into town for South by Southwest if I wanted to get together. And I was like, hey, why don't you come on the show? We'll talk about the podcast and also kind of talk about what's going on in music. What's changed? What has he seen as a guy that's been writing? Like, I knew him when he wrote for the Houston Press back in the 90s, like 90s. I've known him for like 25 years, I think. And he's been writing about me for quite a while and has always been, you know, very cool, very fair, very nice. And we've always kind of gotten along, and I've always stayed in touch with him. But anyway, we talked about where music's going, what he's seen different, what music criticism is now, And also, we take a deep dive into the Magnet Classics podcast, which I really enjoy. Find Magnet Classics podcast wherever it is you stream and download your podcast, or find it at magnetclassicspodcast.com. So now, without further ado, let's talk to my dear old friend, the great journalist, Hobart Rowland. Let's get down. So are you, your thing, what you came to South by Southwest, you got a badge with Magnet?
With Magnet. So I'm covering this for Magnet. Yeah.
Okay. And what is the main line today?
Main line today is a regional publication along the lines of Austin Monthly that covers that
kind
of...
Talk a little closer.
I didn't realize we were on the interview. Yeah. That covers the western suburbs of Philadelphia.
Okay.
So I do that, and then I also edit The Hunt magazine, which is a lifestyle magazine that comes out quarterly in that same region for wealthy horse owners.
Yeah.
We call it the Horsey magazine.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And then Magnet's just my passion. I've been doing it for over 20 years. I'm really friendly with the editor, Eric Miller. He's a great guy. Basically started this magazine from scratch. And
okay, make sure you're talking.
Oh, sorry. Us. Grew it to
fucking journalist, man.
Yeah. I'm not used to it. Us print journalists aren't used to this. Grew it to a pretty substantial national circulation, and then, like a lot of other print publications, suffered some losses with the whole, print just kind of going down the tube. So now they're a website only.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this leads me to something, and it's kind of like I want to quickly touch on the podcast stuff, but I also kind of want to just kind of go through what you see as the change in music, because you've been on the side of a critic, of a reporter, of a mm-hmm. journalist for more than 25 years?
More than 30. I'm dating myself right now, but yeah. Yeah. I've been in a unique position to see a lot of change in the music industry. And you and I touched on this when we spoke. There's the Napster thing and the music availability online. I feel like we've kind of come full circle. I feel like bands are right back to where they were in the 50s, where the only way you're going to make money is to tour. It's ticket sales, doing shows. You're not going to make a lot of money selling records, if any. So it's all about the merch, and it's all about touring. And that's why I think this pandemic has just hammered musicians. I mean,
yeah, that was the one way we could make money.
Yeah, yeah, just clawing at themselves, just wanting to get out there and make money. And but what I have found, it's obviously the music industry is fragmented. It's totally fragmented, but the great thing is anybody can get their music out there. There are countless acts on the bill at South by Southwest this year that are, Spotify acts, bands that just, put their stuff online and got, a million hits, and now are all of a sudden artists to watch. So that's interesting. You can get your music out there. You're just not going to sell a lot of it. you know, you got to find other ways to bring in revenue, and it's mostly with touring and merchandise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as far as writing for Magnet, do they assign you like, oh, go do this guy? Or are you like always like looking through music, checking out what's new, and then like, hey, I'll talk to this guy and then submit that?
The beauty of it with me is that I've had a relationship with Eric for over 20 years, and I'm sort of the Americana singer-songwriter guy for the website. So he pretty much trusts my instincts and pretty much green lights anything I want to do. So if being in the industry as long as I have, I'm fed all of this great music. And,
yeah.
And I had a conversation with somebody last night, and she was asking me, are you seeing a lot of good music right now? And I'm like, actually, I'm seeing an amazing amount of good music.
Right.
The problem is it's not marketed the same way, so you have to go search it out.
Right. And all music, it's all coming at you in the same way.
Exactly.
Like the latest Paul McCartney record or some dude that lives in that apartment over there that just decided to make music on his computer because he was home for a year.
Yeah, you know, you know, it really is. And you know, if we're gonna touch on the old folks, I just got a press release for our Lindsey Buckingham show in Philadelphia, seeing if we wanted to preview and review it. And his latest solo album is one of the favorite things I've heard.
It's great.
It's incredible. Yeah. But you know, damned if I knew anything about it until you know I saw maybe a little nugget about it online, or there was no push to promote it. Like you would see in the past, let's put it that way. And you know, in some ways that's fun because it's a little bit more of a personalized experience. You're discovering stuff on your own. You're not being force-fed stuff,
right?
But it's a whole new world.
yeah.
But there's plenty of great music out there. And one of the other, and I'm going to veer off a little bit here, but one of the other interesting things was that I talked about with this person last night was. The fact that these younger artists, at least especially in my genre, Americana, grew up with their dad's and mom's record collections.
Right.
And, you know, one of the questions I always ask is, how did you discover Guy Clark? Or how did you discover Steve Earle? Or, you know, how do you discover my dad's record collection.
Right.
And then they emulate this stuff and oftentimes add a lot of their own personality to the mix. And you've got something pretty compelling in a lot of cases.
Yeah, you really do. I mean, there is the argument that just what's happening in the mainstream, which is where we used to sort of, I mean, I guess I used to feed off of the side of the mainstream, like on the alternative, on the edges of stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of the time. Yeah. But like what we're being fed in the mainstream right now is to me not human feeling in any way. Like the music that comes on pop radio when you put it on doesn't feel very human. Or sound human.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a weird sort of like human connection is not there right now.
Right now. You know? I think you're right. I think you got to kind of search it out. But, but the one area that where there is a lot of human connection that's very encouraging is that kind of new country area where a lot of these younger country acts are. I'm going to see a band called 49 Winchester. They're from a Virginia town, mountain town, you know, speck of a town.
Yeah.
And these guys, first of all, the guy can sing. And second of all, you know, you look at them and they look like a bunch of kids you see hanging out on a street corner. And they're absolutely, they make an amazing, beautiful sound, you know?
Yeah.
It's incredible, classic country sound with a little tinge of Appalachia in there too, thrown in for good measure. And there's a lot of acts doing that, you know? You know, there's the bigger acts like the Sturgill Simpsons and, but then there's also the smaller acts that are kind of picking up in that same vein and doing a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, before we get into the podcast, one more thing.
Yeah.
I realized last night in thinking about, how long have I known Hobart? How did I know Hobart? I remember seeing you at the place that was around the corner from Power Tools.
Oh, my gosh.
Did I meet you there in that weird room? I remember getting there and being as loud
didn't
as
we meet? Didn't we meet officially for a Houston Satellite? Press story?
I don't think we met somewhere. I think we might have talked on the phone. I know we talked on the phone because that's what I'm getting to. Is I remember like, oh, Hobart wrote that article that I got in trouble with my grandparents for about making out with Alex Vallejo and taking Valium and drinking beer with Jane Weedland.
I don't. Gosh, I wish.
Well, of course,
I remember
you don't remember that. But
I remember Jane Weedland part. I remember the Jane Weedland part. And I remember seeing you at a late 90s showcase at, I'm going to say, Steamboat.
Oh, here.
South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Steamboat's not around anymore, though, right?
No, it's the aquarium now. That's what it is.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk about Magnet Classics.
Yeah.
So quite a while back, at some point, like maybe at this time last year, we talked on the phone one day and you were telling me you were going to start this podcast. And I was freaking out, like, oh, my God, you got to start this right now.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
And you did. And I love this podcast, but I'm going to tell you the two problems I have with it.
Uh-huh.
I wish there was 5 episodes a week.
So do I.
And I wish they were all 7 hours long.
I know.
But that's my own. These are fucking great, Hobart.
Thanks, man.
They're great.
I appreciate that. I appreciate
And I know that there's people, because they definitely scratch an itch, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all those records I had.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially Matthew Sweet. Like, I lived with that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's been, again, a labor of love, and it's a pretty labor-intensive.
It is very labor-intensive.
Because I'm piecing together snippets of interviews that are, you know, have to be strung together to tell a story, and which is essentially the making of an album.
Yeah.
That, I guess... you and I or Magnet would deem a classic album, and they, you know, that's a pretty wide span.
Yeah, it is, because you start the first record, or not, the first one was in the 2000s, but then you go back to 91 and then up to 2002.
Yeah. Yeah, I think our window is probably 90 to, I don't know, 2005. I mean, we're giving ourselves some leeway there, you know, 15-year window of what we consider a classic.
Right.
You know, the one thing that I realize that I have to watch, though, is it's becoming a boys' club. All the albums that I've done so far are male-dominated bands. So, you know, I'm looking into doing some stuff coming up that involves some female artists.
Exactly.
I think
Guyville.
That's important. Tried to reach out. That one I'm still working on. The other one that I thought would be great would be The Breeders' Last Splash.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's, believe it or not, going to be 30 years old in 2023. That album is going to be 30 years. It makes you feel old, doesn't it?
Yeah. All of it makes me feel old.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually working on a story on the Blake Babies, Sunburn, which is Juliana Hatfield's old band. So there we go. There we get the female element there. But so, you know, it's a lot of fun. And basically it just grew out of these stories that Magnet, these Magnet Classic series that the magazine has been doing for 20 years. And it's typically an oral history where you do these interviews and then you just transcribe and string the quotes together. I've always loved oral histories because it's a challenge, and it's almost like putting pieces of a puzzle together.
Yeah.
Trying to tell a narrative without any kind of padding from the narrator himself. I mean, there's very little padding. I do a beginning, a few things at the end.
Yeah, it's all the other people.
Yeah. And there's just satisfaction in being able to put to string a story together from all these disparate elements, you know, that are coming from different times and different interviews. For example, the Nigel Godrich segment of the Travis podcast was actually the lead singer, Fran Healy, interviewing Nigel Godrich.
Oh, really?
At his home. And Nigel just had twins, so he was not really available for an interview per se, but Fran was able to talk him into doing this interview. And if you listen very closely in a few of the segments, you can hear one of his babies screaming in the other room, like very lightly. I tried to get it out. I couldn't get it out. I said, you know what? That adds character to
it.
Yeah.
How awesome. Man, that friend, those guys, we hung out with them when I was in Gowdy.
They're the sweetest guys in the
world. We met them through, remember that band Remy Zero?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Those guys were super good friends with them. And then Gowdy spent a week in L.A., and I had become friends with St. John and Jeffrey, the guitar player guy?
Yeah.
And so we hung out every night for a week, like all three bands. And those guys were, they're so fucking hilarious and so awesome.
Yeah, they're good guys, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how this one does, because that album is a little bit unique in that it did extremely well overseas, like multi-platinum, major. I mean, they were the band in the UK for a while,
right?
And it did okay in the States, but it didn't blow any sales records or anything like that.
I'm sure I would have heard it, but I had never. It was really weird because we met them in January of 2000, and they had, I guess they were just coming over to do the Man Who press and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and because they were doing shit all day, all of us were all doing shit all day, and then we'd hang out all night.
Yeah,
and that week was so crazy party that the last night Remy Zero had a party at their place for everyone, and Einar passed out like face first. And
I would have liked to have seen that.
It was scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually saw Travis. I knew nothing about them, and I went and saw them saw Oasis and they opened for Oasis.
Oh, yeah.
And that was when they were touring behind The Man Who, which is also a great record.
Such a great record.
Yeah. And my mind was blown. I'm like, where were the, how did I miss these guys?
Yeah.
And that's basically how they got an American audience, as Fran says in the podcast, was they basically toured the shit out of America,
yeah,
you know, as much as they could. And, you know, and got huge, obviously, in their home country and in other European countries. But, you know, we're more of just like a touring act here.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
They told us this story, I remember, because I remember going like, we had never heard of these guys, but they're really, really famous, like somewhere. You know what I mean? Because I remember when we went to leave, like going to the airport, they used to have magazines, all like Q and like all of the British ones. They were like on the cover.
Yeah.
But they were saying that one night they were watching some talk show and Paul McCartney was going to be on it. And they were real stoked to see it. And the guy asked Paul McCartney what he had been listening to. And he had a guitar in his hand. And he started playing Why Does It Always Rain on Me? And they were like watching TV.
Oh, my
God. They were like, oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. And the great thing about them is they're music fans. So, you know, the part in the podcast with Jason Faulkner, who is this,
one of my favorites, a
genius, but is not an everyday name. I mean, people, you know, he was with Jellyfish for, you know, their one semi-hit album and then moved on and just did all this amazing stuff. And, you know, the fact that, you know, they were singing his song in the background when Nigel Godrich called him to get him to come down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just very cool.
Yeah. So cool. I was reminded of a thing in The Office because I remember how weird it was watching The Office and seeing them listening to that. So I was like, what an odd sort of song. Like some producer of this show, like this is their favorite.
It's a Travis fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that was just an odd choice in a show. Like it was a few years old. It was a band people didn't really know, and it wasn't a song that was huge.
Yeah.
But Fran talking about how that kind of took off after that, I was like, wow, those moments now, like that's how you promote a record now.
Yeah, get it into a TV show.
Yeah.
I mean, you do.
Yeah.
And then you have other artists that are kind of a marginally commercial, you know, on the margins commercially, that actually make a living out of getting placement in commercials and TV shows.
But this was actually like, it was even more than that. It was literally the most compelling relationship on mainstream television at the time was Jim and Pam.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first moment that they were having this sort of like shared connection thing.
Yeah.
It's also like kismet where you're like, oh yeah. Because I remember going like, oh, I love that song. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Imagine people were just like, it became people's songs that had never even heard of Travis.
Yeah. I was watching American Idol the other night and there was a scene with one of the contestants at home finding out that they had gotten they'd gotten a spot on the show, and Tyler Ramsey, who is the former guitarist for Band of Horses, who put out this really fantastic solo album that really didn't go anywhere. I did a piece on it, and there's the song going in the background that somebody must have been, some producer at the show must have been, this is an amazing song, let's drop it into the background of American Idol. I'm thinking, I'm sure he knows, and I'm sure he's getting compensation for that, but it's funny that this stuff randomly just shows up, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I was wondering this today, how much, like, how long did you talk to Fran? Like when you, like how much, I'm trying to figure out just as another podcast guy, like how much is he editing?
It was a Zoom call with Fran in LA and Dougie Payne in the UK. So I had both of them on for probably about an hour.
Okay.
So there's definitely stuff that I didn't use.
Yeah, yeah.
The great thing about them is they're obviously just so close friends that they interact with each other so well that there wasn't a lot of editing that had to be done when they were kind of teeing off on each other and talking about stuff. And then having Fran sort of as the interviewer for the Nigel Godrich worked out really well too, because there's some really funny moments where he was kind of ribbing Nigel about, you know, how he was in a pissy mood because he just finished Kid A.
Yeah.
And he was been stuck with
Radiohead. He wanted to have fun.
Yeah. So, and you know, and then, you know, the goofy thing, you know, Dougie Payne. It was painful. Was it Dougie Painful? You know, like, so it's obviously that they all have a really close relationship. And to me, that those are the moments that I love the best, when you see the relationship between the musicians and the producers.
Yeah.
And I often find that the interviews with the producers are much more illuminating than the musicians, because the producers were so invested in the album. For example, that Matthew Sweet's Girlfriend album, we got way more insights from Fred.
Fred Marr
and Jim Rondinelli.
Yeah.
Than I did from Matthew, because Matthew honestly doesn't remember. I mean, he remembers it, but he wasn't the one behind the boards. They're the ones kind of corralling the madness. What I mean, and making sure it all comes out. And Jim Rondinelli is actually a very successful product developer, and he's actually here. It's at South by Southwest,
Oh, really?
So we're going to try to meet for coffee. Yeah, he lives in Seattle now. He's got some sort of a software that isolates instruments that is actually really taking off. So he's here promoting that.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
We worked with Fred Marr. Gowdy did.
Yeah.
Because we threw away our record that we made with him, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But
did you like working with him?
Fuck.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite people I ever met. And we got him because of that record.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't because of I Want to Know What You're Thinking by Information Society.
or the Lloyd Cole solo album.
No, I love those records.
I do too, but it's funny because, and they talk about that in the podcast.
Yeah.
The drastic change in the sound.
Oh, he's even on there.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to, for example, you listen to that Lloyd Cole album, that first album, then you listen to Girlfriend, you would never know that's the same producer.
Right.
I mean, it was just a complete, the 80s sound versus this new sound. And I think Jim had a lot to do with that, too. That sort of, it's a live-to-tape feel, but it's deceptive because it's really not.
Right.
But they made it sound like, no, you know, everything compressed, no reverb.
Right.
That kind of dry sound.
Yeah.
Was very new and revolutionary, and then it fell in right with the Nirvana Nevermind thing,
right?
And in a weird way. So then you have this, it's almost this new sound that was just finding its way in that, during that particular period of time, those couple of years.
We were all in New York one time with Fred, and he took us to that studio. It was above Studio 54.
Yeah, it's not a very glamorous place.
It is. When you walk in, you're like, oh, that's what that record sounds like. It's in this little tiny place with no room. Yeah.
I've never been there, but I've heard about four or five different descriptions, and they're all the same.
Yeah.
Tiny.
Yeah. I remember, like, we all walked in. We were like, where was everyone? And they were like,
yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah.
He's both of those drummers on that record, both guitar players, that record to me is really like.
Fred's a great drummer too.
Such an intuitive, great drummer.
And most of that stuff was like one take, he said.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And obviously Rick Meng's a great drummer too. But I mean, that album is just the cast of characters on that album, from Richard Lloyd and. I mean,
Robert Quine,
to that record. It's unbelievable. And that one was a lot of fun. And actually, that was has been my most pop. I've only three podcasts, but it'll be interesting to see if the Travis surpasses that one. I mean, Pete did well. Matthew Sweet went through the roof. And I had listeners from China. I mean, it was crazy. People, he has a weird fan
base. He does.
Base
I was going to say that. I was like, it's weird because he's a lot more famous than he thinks he is.
I know.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of reclusive now.
Yeah.
And he admits it himself. You know, he just kind of hangs, stays with himself. He lives in Nebraska, back where.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He went back to take care of his mom, who was not doing well. I think it was his mom, or maybe it was his, it might have been his wife's mom. But so he and his wife are still there. They're still just, hanging out.
I guess you can say this because whatever, who cares? Statute of limitations. Me and Einar scored him this weed because we got high with him and he was like, oh my God, where are you getting this stuff? And we're like, oh, from our guy, our record label guy. And he's like, can you get me some? We're like, sure. So he came out to get it when we were recording in Venice Beach and he showed up in the Altered Beast car. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. That must have been interesting.
Einar and I were freaking out on him, like, oh my God, this is really your car? Like, yeah, this is my car, man.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a piece of work. I mean, he's still making some pretty good music, too.
We saw him a few years ago. Anar and I both went to go see him, and he had broken his leg, and he had the flu.
Yeah.
And it was it.
He's
not his best show.
He's battled through some health issues, yeah. I think. And he was battling through those when I did it wasn't COVID, but I think he was dealing with something. And it was getting him to do the versions of Girlfriend and Divine Intervention for that podcast. Took a while to turn those around because he wasn't he actually went into the studio and recorded those especially for the podcast.
Oh wow! Did Pete do that too?
Pete did his on the spot. He's just that's the way he is. He'll just take a guitar. He's the guy always has a guitar.
I thought those were like weird songwriting demos.
No.
Oh fuck, that's cool.
Yeah, so you can go on to magnetpodcast.com and hear the full versions of those songs.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and the Travis songs are also exclusive to the podcast. You can't find them anywhere else. Those were live, acoustic live performances that they did at some point that just never got used, and Kraft Recordings gave us the rights to use those.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's cool. You have some extra music. And, you know, my next one, I've also got some great, next one's going to be Not a Surf's Let Go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, that's not the one Fred produced.
That was actually not produced by anybody. It was significant. It was mostly produced by the band with some help from an engineer.
Okay.
I'm not sure who that is. Now I feel bad that I'm not giving this person credit. But, you know, they were at a point at that point where they'd lost their contract with, I think, was it Elektra? You know, Elektra wanted another popular.
Right.
And they were not going to do that.
And that was the record they did with Fred.
Yeah.
And then they let it go and went back.
Exactly. And then they lost the rights to their second album, and they were in the middle of trying to get the rights back for that second album and trying to record Let Go. And Let Go is really a probably the turning point album for them as far as figuring out that, wow, you know, we can just be a really good pop band.
Yeah.
Like and those guys can just, Matthew is just an amazing songwriter.
Yeah.
And so that's gonna be an exciting one to do.
Set the record with the "What if they did that to your sister?"
This one has got "Inside of Love" on it. I wanna know what it's like on the inside of love.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the one that fans turn to as, okay, this is when Not a Surf really became the Not a Surf we know now, you know?
Right.
And, you know, we don't have to be a hokey novelty band. We can actually, you know, sustain a career, and they have. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, they're not massive, but
no.
they've got great career. They've got a great career. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So wait, you live in Philadelphia now?
I live outside of Philadelphia.
Okay.
Correct.
And are you from there originally?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm actually living right now where I was about 20 minutes from where I was born and raised.
So how did you end up in Houston?
I was convinced that I was going to be a music journalist full time and thinking I could make a career out of that. And I got an offer from New Times to become the music editor for the Houston Press. And my wife had never lived anywhere else. I'd lived a few places. So I asked her to marry me and said, "Oh, and by the way, will you move to Houston with me?" Houston? Yeah. Philadelphia and Houston. I mean,
sure.
You know,
yeah, it's
they're
it's
very
different.
Different.
Yeah. And the idea of Houston when you're from Philadelphia is like, what?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Why Houston?
People have horns on their Cadillacs.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I have, I kind of fell in love with that city. In some ways it reminded me of Philadelphia because it always seems if you're from Dallas and say you talk to somebody from Dallas and you say, "Yeah, I lived in Texas." And they say, "Where'd you live?" And you say, "Houston." And they kind of roll their eyes.
Yeah.
It's like Houston is sort of like the Philadelphia to Dallas.
Right.
Or I'm sorry, am I saying that
Pittsburgh?
Right? Philly Houston is to Dallas what Philly is to New York.
Oh, okay.
So New
okay.
It's like, oh, it's the other city.
Right, right.
It's the other city.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And yeah. So in that way, I always felt like Houstonites are always going out of the way to make you feel welcome.
Right.
And I gained about 25 pounds in 3 years just eating the food. It's yeah. insane. It's an amazing restaurant town. I don't think a lot of people know that.
It's yeah, I mean, it's a great, I think there's actually a Top Chef there right now.
Yeah.
I think it's like Top Chef Houston yeah. is happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a great town. So what made you, started off playing drums and playing music?
I started off drums at a pretty young age. I played in bands in high school and college. You know, the dream is always you want to be in a band.
Sure.
And I think with a lot of music journalists, you know, I read a lot of books now, but I didn't do a lot of, wasn't very book well read from a book standpoint until I got into my 20s. But I devoured music journalism pretty much growing up. Trouser Press, Cream, Rolling Stone, Spin. I just, you know, I was really into Tom Moon, who was the Philadelphia Inquirer critic that's kind of gone national since it's gone national. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of connected the dots, I think, after college and kind of rambled through college, not really knowing what I wanted to do. And then I covered a few concerts for the school newspaper, and I said, maybe I could do this. But then I...
Remember what concerts they were?
Yeah, In Excess. This is a great one. In Excess played the gym at Ithaca College, my alma mater. That was the second show on their Kick tour. And this was when, I don't know if you remember this, but this was when Atlantic was telling them, we're not releasing this record. They basically went to the In Excess and said, this is too R&B. You're not an R&B band. You're not releasing this record. And they basically said, and this is a true story, they went back to Atlantic and said, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to prove you wrong. Their manager said, we're going to do a college tour. And we're going to air out these songs in front of a live audience. And let's see what kind of reaction we get. So we were on that tour. Our college was a stop on that tour. And I'll tell you what, I got to go backstage, hang out with Gary Beers.
Wow.
I had beers with Gary Beers. I had a big tub full of Corona, I'll never forget. So this is like 1987.
Yeah.
And Michael Hutchins, you know, showed up, you know, girl draped over his shoulder. And then they just came out and they just blew the doors off of our gym. I mean, it was, they were amazing live band.
Oh yeah, they were.
And
amazing.
To see them in a gym, in a college gym, and that's all it took. That album, weeks later, that album went through the roof.
Yeah.
Yeah. A great story. What was the other band? Oh, The Alarm.
Oh, wow.
I played soccer in the gym after the show with the members of The Alarm.
That's awesome.
Great guys. And the other one was Debbie Gibson came.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So those are my three live concert reviews for college. And then I just, you know, I came home and I got a job as a stringer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, which means I would be covering the most boring zoning meetings. I wanted to get my journalistic chops together.
Right.
But I still had in the back of my mind, I wanted to do music.
Right.
And then I went back to school and got my master's in journalism at Arizona State University. And I just happened to plop down at Arizona State when the whole Desert Rock thing was. The Gin Blossoms were playing clubs. The Meat Puppets had just signed to London Records. So they were, you know, they were becoming this sort of Phoenix phenomenon.
Right.
So it was a really great time to be in Phoenix, Arizona at that point, because there was a lot of good music.
Yeah.
So that just bit the bug even more, you know, it just made me even more. And I got involved with the university newspaper, and that's when my music writing really took off. I started doing a lot of stuff for the State Press, which is this, you know, ASU's massive university. So, you know, you actually got paid to work for the newspaper, which is a college newspaper, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
So, I think it just snowballed from there. I took some jobs. I took a job outside of DC. I worked for as a lifestyle editor. But the Houston Press was a big one for me, because that was the first time that I was solely devoting my career to covering music. and it was a great 3 years. We were just talking about a conversation with somebody last night about the fabulous Satellite Lounge and all those great clubs.
Yeah.
In Houston. So that was a big turning point for me, was my time in Texas.
What was going on in Houston at that time? Were there any bands? The Jinkies, I remember, were a band that was happening mm-hmm. then. So it was like,
oh man, oh, the Hollisters. They were retro country before retro country was cool.
Oh yeah. Jarvis's band, the Saunier Brothers.
Yep.
Remember those guys?
Yep, the Saunier's. Yep. I did quite a few. They were great guys too.
Yeah.
Really nice guys. And you know, I saw a lot of great shows from touring acts that came through there, and obviously I got a serious education in Texas singer-songwriter. I mean, I had to figure that out quick. You know, the Guy Clarks,
yeah.
the Robert Earl Keens, Jerry Jeff Walkers. I'm like, who are these guys?
Did you go to see all those guys and stuff?
I got to see Guy Clark at Rockefeller's.
Oh, that's great.
When he was still in good health. Uh-huh. And it was a great show. I arrived, I think Townes Van Zandt had passed away pretty close to when I arrived, so I missed him. Saw Jerry Jeff, saw Robert Earl Keene. Remember Jack Ingram?
Oh, yeah.
Remember Jack Ingram?
Of
course. And
Jack Ingram's doing really well now.
Yeah.
Like
he's a writer too, right? Doesn't he write for other people and do that the yeah. Nashville thing?
Yeah.
So a lot of good times, a lot of great shows. I thought, you know, they're doing this whole thing on Mojo Nixon. He has a documentary, and they're screening it here at South by Southwest, and he's doing a couple special events. And I was going through an old photo album, and they had a surprise birthday party for my 30th birthday party at this fabulous Satellite Lounge. And there's a picture of me, and Mojo was playing that night, and me with my arm around Mojo Nixon.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So it's interesting. A lot of good memories.
Yeah. Does he live here?
I don't
know. Why is he always here?
I don't know.
He was really mean to me one day.
Oh, I see. Yeah. He's a little bit of a odd duck, but he's, I think, in general.
Somebody told me right after, I can't remember what it was he said, I sang like a girl.
Oh,
and
man.
I said, thanks. And he was like, that wasn't a fucking compliment. Like, it was really like, hey, dude, like, I'm telling you, I don't like you. And
oh,
I was just like, okay, whatever.
Man.
And then a friend of mine was like, man, he insulted you? I was like, that's a badge of honor, man. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of looked at it as like, oh, yeah, he didn't like me.
Yeah. You know, and I still keep in touch with the guys from Banana Blender Surprise and, you know, Alan Hill and Dave Beebe, who's now.
Alan's up here right now.
Yep.
Isn't he?
Dave's in Marfa. He was the Justice of the Peace of Marfa, Texas for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, Dave is the guy that signed Justice Scalia's death certificate.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we're missing an act that was pretty huge, big in Houston, is Jesse Dayton.
Oh yeah,
was a Beaumont, Texas boy, but he kind of got his start in Houston.
Yeah,
remember Justice Records?
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
That was.
Yeah, I'm gonna
Jumail's.
Go. I'm gonna go see. I think he's playing Continental Club. I think he's gonna do.
Yeah, Continental Sunday afternoon. I know. I'm gonna try and go see him there because that's a good show. I'll show.
Yeah, that's he does that post, and unfortunately, I'm heading out too early for that. But that's always fun.
Randall Jumail, that was Justice, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good guy, man.
Yeah, he tried. He tried to make it work, you know? He did.
Yeah. I always liked that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in a band, and we used to stay with him when we'd go. And it was like, he would show up in the morning and be like, I brought y'all raw oysters. Like, it was always just the most fancy shit you
could
imagine.
Oh, yeah, because that's what he was. That was his lifestyle.
Yeah, every bed was a sleep number bed. I remember that. It was the first time I ever saw a sleep number bed.
Yeah. A lot of those clubs, though, are gone, you know, in Houston. Like Blanco's was the other place I used to love, the old dance hall club.
Fitzgerald's is gone. We played the last show there.
Satellite's
Skyrocket
gone.
Did. Satellite's gone. Yeah, yeah, Satellite's been gone for a while.
Rockefeller's is around, but apparently it's not. It's the same as it was. It's more of a special events place now, right?
Yeah. It's not the venue.
Well, that whole Washington Avenue strip, was unrecognizable to me when I saw it after coming back. It's kind of seedy.
Yeah.
It's not seedy anymore.
No.
Yeah.
No. It's
and Leo's is gone, obviously, too.
Yeah. I know.
I have one more good Texas story if you want to hear
that?
It. Houston Press brought me down, my wife down, and I for a visit. It was excruciatingly hot. It was July. Houston in July. And we stayed, I remember we stayed at the Drury Inn in Houston. And we didn't know much about Houston, so I'd heard about Leo's because I'm a big ZZ Top fan.
Right.
But I'd also heard that, you know, Leo's had this shrine to ZZ Top. So
yeah.
We went in there and had a meal. You know, the food was never great. I mean, it was what it was. It was a Tex-Mex joint that was kind of, I think, past its expiration date a little bit.
Right.
So we get there and we're like, oh, kind of cool. You know, we see the ZZ Top shrine and we're getting out to leave. And as we walk out, there is a cherry red convertible with the top down, like a classic. I don't know. I'm not a car guy, so I don't know. I'm like, I wonder whose car that is. And literally, as we get in the car, put the key ignition.
Billy Gibbons
walks out, and he has a cat with him. He gets in the car, looks over, smiles at us, gets in the car with the cat, and drives off. And I'm like, okay, this is a sign. We're moving to Houston. This is a sign.
That's another one of the nicest guys in show business.
Oh yeah, just great guy. It stinks that we lost Dusty and all that. And I met Frank. Frank's a good guy too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember. Billy is a guy that like I knew from Satellite Lounge.
Yeah.
Like, because we used to do a lot of shows with what was the Malford Milligan band with
Storyville.
With Chris Simmons. Yeah. With Chris.
That was the other one I was going to mention. Storyville, and you know he was on The Voice. He didn't make it.
But
he was, yeah. Did you know that? He was a contestant on The Voice.
And then he moved to like Amsterdam.
I think he lost by one vote.
Oh, really?
Somebody, yeah, everybody. I don't, yeah, he could still sing.
Oh, God. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
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 I love that guy.
Yeah.
So the next one's going to be Not a Surf on the
Not a Surf's process. Let Go. And then it looks like tentatively we've got the Blake Baby Sunburn as the next one.
That'll be great.
Yeah. So it'd be, get some female blood in there.
Yeah. Man, it's a couple of things. One of them, thank you always for being so supportive. I've always appreciated it.
Absolutely.
Second of all, you've always been a really nice guy and fun to talk to.
Yeah.
And third, thank you for making this podcast. Because really, like, when I wrote you back after you sent me the link, I just saw that this morning where I was like, this is awesome. And you're like, really?
Yeah.
Like, yes, it is awesome.
I wish it was more glam. The production of it was more glamorous. It's basically me with a pair of headphones and my laptop and the GarageBand just like slaving away in my sunroom at my house, like putting it together.
It's got like 100 times the production value of this show. Like this, like, there's going to be birds in the background.
It's okay.
But yeah, no, I really appreciate it. I love the records that you're doing, and you do a really good job of putting it together. And I was going to say, I love those where what were you saying, where everybody tells a story? What is it called?
An oral history.
An oral history.
Yeah.
Like that MTV book. Did you read that?
Isn't that incredible?
Oh my God.
Yeah. You know what else? The other one I would recommend is Bowie's oral biography.
I think it's
Dylan. It's a well-known journalist that did it. Man, if you want to know some stuff about Bowie, and I know you're a Bowie fan, you will just devour that book.
Dude, I will.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll do it. Magnet Classics, people can go to the Magnet website and see all of the special stuff on there.
Yep, and then there's my website, which is magnetclassicspodcast.com.
Oh, okay.
So there's two, and obviously you can get it on all the major platforms.
Yeah.
Apple, Spotify, Amazon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, congratulations, dude.
Yep.
You've done a great job. I hope
Thanks,
you like doing it and you can, like, don't cut me off, dude. Don't cut me off. Like, you got to keep on making them at least for a while.
Look, as long as I have time to do it, you know, I am going to keep doing it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. It's great talking to you, Hoba.
Thanks for having me.
My dear old friend Hobart Roland, what a great conversation, man. Check out his Magnet Classics podcast wherever it is you stream or download podcasts. Check out their extra content at magnetclassicspodcast.com. Great, great show. Great, great, great podcast. I love that show. I wish there was more of them. I wish there was 1,000 episodes I could listen to all the time. I'm serious. I do love it. Great having Hobart on. Go to magnetclassicspodcast.com for all of your Magnet Classics podcast. Okay. Don't forget, at gang, when you're out there checking out Magnet Classics podcasts, you can also subscribe to this podcast, follow us, give us a rating, wherever it is that you do it. If you do it on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Overcast, Spotify, leave us a rating, follow us, let us know how we're doing. Leave a comment, share it, use the hashtag HDIGH, and I'll give you a shout out on the show, all right? Go check out Magnet Classics Podcast. Have a great day, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down. And then I saw you coming my way. Don't you need to get back in the arms of a good friend? Oh, cause honey, believe me, she'd love to call you my girlfriend. You need to get back in the arms of a good friend. Oh, cause honey, believe me, sure love to call you my girlfriend. Cause you got a good thing going, baby. You only need somebody to love. Well, you got a good thing going. Looking for someone to love.